We were in that particular section where the individual manager is going to evaluate. He's going to evaluate the decisions which he has made. In the threefold process, the decision has been studied, the decision has been made, and now the decision must be tested. Did the problem disappear? If not, was the failure due to the decision itself or to some fault in the implementation of the decision? At what point did the flaw enter the application process? Should the leader ever change his mind after a decision has been made and implemented? Well, the answer is both positive and negative. Here are some concepts, principles to remember when the decision should not be changed. Number one, obstacles are blocking progress, but it is possible that in time implementation will be successful and the problem will be resolved. And then another time when the decision should not be changed. Some people are reacting negatively, but there's no reason to believe that their actions in any way represent error in the decision itself. And then a third time when decisions should not be changed. The implementation is difficult, but possible. Difficulty can be expected, but there's no reason to turn back because of difficulty. But then there are some times when decisions should be changed. For example, if new facts are available which alter the identification of causes or specification of solutions for the problem, then certainly in light of that, those new facts, the decision should be changed. Or the situation has changed and the context in which the decision was made has been sufficiently altered to render the former decision inadequate under these new conditions, and the decision should be changed. Or thirdly, there was really faulty reasoning that has become apparent in the decision-making process. The leader will make mistakes, but if he's wise, he will recognize and correct them, even if it means withdrawing a decision previously made. Well, how can we evaluate ourselves as a decision maker? Perhaps we could begin with this statement. Decision makers are made, not born. The process of leadership involvement, which is discussed throughout this course of management science, indicates that there are traits and gifts which may be an aid in some persons to enable them to function effectively as leaders in certain situations, but that most of management behavior is a process of adequate training. Most of management behavior is a process of adequate training. Let me share just a checklist that can be used to evaluate yourself and others within your organization relative to the adequacy with which the decision-making process is used. Questions may be answered yes or no, or most of the time, or rarely. Listen to these questions. How would you answer them? Number one, are the objectives of the organization clear to me? Number two, are the objectives of the organization clear to my subordinates? Number three, do I carefully consider the overall goals of the organization when making decisions? Number four, am I able to specifically specify individual goals for myself as well as general objectives for the organization? Number five, do I tend to shrink from decision making, or do I face each decision with the courage and conviction necessary to handle it competently? Number six, am I able to analyze my own problems clearly? Number seven, do I generally have difficulty in analyzing the problems of others for whom I am responsible? Number eight, am I able to properly distinguish the cause? Number nine, am I able to verbalize understandable statements about organizational and individual problems? Number ten, do I have sufficient rapport with colleagues and subordinates to effectively gather information for this decision-making process? Number 11, Does decision-making occupy an inordinate amount of time? That is, do I spend too much time gathering information and procrastinating the actual decision itself? Number 12. Am I consistent regarding the accuracy of the facts in every decision-making situation? Number 13. Do I face the issues open-mindedly, honestly, considering the various alternatives? Number 14. Do I generally achieve good acceptance of my decision by the personnel in the organization? Number 15. Are people agreeing to implement my decisions because of fear of my authority or respect for my judgment? Number 16. Do I tend to get unduly involved in my decisions to the point that I react emotionally if someone challenges the wisdom of this decision? Number 17. Am I too unilaterally or dictatorial in decision making? That is, do I fail to delegate decisions that can be delegated? Number 18. Do my decisions show a logical pattern of consistency over a period of time? Or does each one relate only to itself rather than to the whole? Number 19. Am I able to help other people make decisions as well as make them myself? Number 20. Am I able to evaluate the wisdom and correctness of the decision? It's certainly important for the leader to realize that decision making is a process which lacks permanency. That is, decisions made today, which may be entirely correct and profitable for the improvement progress of the organization, may need to be rethought and revisited within the next 5 years, if not sooner. It's necessary to build into the decision-making process a feedback which provide a long-run continuous testing with options for revision as the events brought about by the decisions fall into place. Peter Drucker pinpoints this necessity. Decisions are made by men. Men are fallible. At their best, their works do not last long. Even the best decision has a high probability of being wrong. Even the most effective one eventually becomes obsolete. One needs organized information for the feedback. One needs reports and figures. But unless one builds one's feedback around direct exposure to reality, unless one disciplines oneself to go out and look, one condemns oneself to a sterile dogmatism, and with it, to ineffectiveness. Thomas Bateman, in his book entitled Management, Function, and Structure, has made this statement. Decisions. If you can't make them, you won't be an effective manager. Managers, of course, face this decision-making process constantly. Managers face problems constantly. Some problems that require decision are relatively simple. Others seem overwhelming. Some demand immediate action, while others take months or even years to unfold. Actually, managers often ignore problems. For several reasons, they avoid taking action. First, managers can't be sure how much time, energy, or trouble lies ahead once they start working on a problem. Second, getting involved is risky. Tackling a problem but failing to solve it successfully can hurt the manager's track record. And third, because problems can be so perplexing, it is easier to procrastinate or to get busy with less demanding activities. Well-structured problems have objectively correct answers. They can be solved by using simple rules or numerical computations. For example, if you're a small business owner and must decide the amounts for your employees' paychecks, you can use a calculator. And if the amounts are wrong, your employees will prove it to you. If most important decisions were well structured, managerial life would be much easier. But managers typically face ill-structured problems. Problems with no proven answers, at least not until sometime in the future. Such problems may have a number of possible solutions, all of which have merits as well as drawbacks. Decisions are made more or less difficult by the amount and quality of pertinent information available to the decision maker. With complete information, the decision maker can determine the amount of risk in a decision. Risk is most easily determined under conditions of certainty. Certainty exists when the manager has accurate, comprehensive information. In other words, the manager fully understands the problem. He knows all the options, and he can accurately predict the results of implementing the various alternatives. But certainty alone does not necessarily lead to a successful decision. Even if a decision maker approaches certainty, a decision can be risky. Risk exists when the probability of success is less than 100%. Risk can be accurately assessed under conditions of certainty if the manager has all of the information that will enable him or her to make accurate predictions. Some degree of risk is inherent in virtually all decisions. However, a decision predicted to have a 90% chance of success is far less risky than one with a 20% probability of success. Perfect certainty, in which the amount of risk is clear and easily determined, is rare. For important, ill-structured managerial problems, uncertainty is the rule. Uncertainty means that the manager has insufficient information about the probabilities of success and failure. Decision makers may have strong opinions, but they still face uncertainty if they lack pertinent information that help them accurately assess their options. Uncertainty is the business executive's adversary. Although uncomfortable for many managers, uncertainty is an inevitable circumstance of decision-making. The constant state of uncertainty presents two challenges for decision-makers. First, decision-makers must be decisive despite the uncertainties. When the time comes to act, such as when delay would mean missing out on a great opportunity, they must make a choice even though they desire more information. Second, decision makers must learn how to put up with uncertainty for as long as possible. Many people make decisions just to get them over with, which means the uncertainty is overwhelming them and they want to resolve it. But as Harvard Business School professors teach their MBA students, managers should not make a decision until they have to. In other words, delay can be valuable if you're not under time pressure and you know how to get information that will reduce uncertainty and help you make a better informed decision. Important decisions are even more difficult because of the conflict they introduce. Conflict, which exists when the manager must consider opposing pressures from different sources, occurs really at two different levels. First, individual decision makers experience psychological conflict. A manager may be forced to make an undesirable decision. For example, a manager has to lay off some employees and they face the decision of whether to fire people based on their seniority or their performance. Either way, she must make an unpopular, uncomfortable choice. Or a manager has three promising job applicants but can hire only one. In this situation, he must say no to two highly qualified people. Second, conflict arises between individuals or groups. The chief financial officer argues in favor of increasing long-term debt to finance an acquisition. The chief executive officer, however, prefers to minimize such debt and find the funds elsewhere. The marketing department wants more product lines to sell to its customers, and engineers want high-quality products. But production people want to lower costs by having longer production runs of fewer products with no changes. Management wants to enforce some rigid work rules, while labor seeks loose rule enforcement. As you can see, few decisions are unanimous or uncompromised. Despite these difficulties, managers are expected to make decisions rationally. By making decisions rationally, we mean to gather information, objectively weigh the evidence, consider all the alternatives, and make the choices that will lead to the best possible outcomes. This ideal is seldom realized, however. Typically, managers must employ a less than perfect form of rationality, which has been called bounded rationality. This concept suggests that in the real world, decision makers can rarely do a complete rational analysis because decisions are complex and complete information is usually unavailable. Furthermore, people are not always capable of knowing, understanding, or objectively interpreting all available information. Because of these limitations, decision makers rarely maximize or make ideal decisions that result in the best possible outcome. More commonly, managers satisfice. They choose options that appear adequate, are minimally acceptable, but are not perfect. This often means that managers do not expect the time or energy to gather complete, perfect information. Rather, they make the expedient decision based on readily available information. Moreover, managers must try to optimize in their decision-making. Faced with many decisions and goals, they simply cannot do a perfect job on all of them. To improve one area of operation, they must make sacrifices in other areas. Attention devoted to one decision detracts from the time available to others. Thus, managers cannot realistically hope to perfectly and simultaneously maximize productivity, sales, return on investment, and employees' well-being. But those who can optimize, that is, obtain a balance of good results across all of these dimensions, are fulfilling their managerial responsibilities well. The ideal decision-making process moves through various well-defined stages. These stages are, number one, identify and diagnose the problem. Number two, generate alternative solutions. Number three, evaluate these alternatives. Number four, make the choice. Number five, implement the decision. And number six, evaluate the decision. The first stage in the decision-making process is to recognize that a problem exists and must be solved. Typically, a manager realizes some discrepancy between the current state, that is, the way things are, and the desired state, the way things ought to be. Such discrepancies, say in organization or departmental performance, may be directed by comparing current performance against past performance, or the current performance of other organization departments, or future expected performance as determined by plans and forecasts. Recognizing that a problem exists is only the beginning of this stage. The decision maker must also want to do something about it and must believe that the resources and abilities necessary for solving the problem do actually exist. Then the decision maker must dig in deeper and attempt to diagnose the true cause of the problem symptoms that surfaced. For example, a sales manager knows that sales have dropped drastically. He's leaving the company soon or believes the decreased sales volume is due to the economy, which he can't do anything about, he won't take further action. But if he does try to solve the problem, he should not automatically reprimand his sales staff, add new people, or increase the advertising budget. He must analyze why sales are down and then develop a solution appropriate to his analysis. So, the first step in this problem-solving process is to identify and to diagnose the problem. And then the second step is to generate alternative solutions. In the second step, problem diagnosis is linked to the development of alternative courses of action which are aimed at solving the problem. Managers generate at least some alternative solutions based on past experience. Solutions range from ready-made to custom-made. Decision-makers who search for ready-made solutions use ideas they have seen or tried before or follow the advice of others who have faced similar problems. Custom-made solutions, on the other hand, can be designed for the specific problems. The technician requires combining ideas into new, creative solutions. Choosing a ready-made alternative is much easier than designing a custom-made solution. Therefore, most decision-makers use the ready-made approach, sometimes even when the ready-made alternative is inappropriate. If this approach fails to uncover an acceptable solution, the harder work of devising a unique solution will begin. For important, irreversible decisions, custom-made alternatives should be developed because they are more likely to lead to high-quality solutions. And then the third step, we said first you identify and diagnose the problem. Secondly, you generate alternative solutions. Then thirdly, you evaluate these alternatives. The third stage involves determining the value or adequacy of the alternatives that were generated. Which solution will be best? Alternatives obviously should be evaluated more carefully, day by day. Fundamental to this process is the ability to predict the consequences that will occur if the various options are put into effect. So number one, identify and diagnose the problem. Number two, generate alternative solutions. Number three, evaluate the alternatives. And then number four, think of the consequences. Managers should consider several types of consequences. Obviously, they must attempt to predict the effects on financial or other performance measures. But there are less clear-cut consequences to address. First, decisions set a precedent. Will this precedent be a help or a hindrance in the future? Second, the success or failure of the decision will go into the track record of those involved in making the decision. So as you're evaluating these alternatives, you're looking at the consequences involved. As you're evaluating these alternatives, you're going to examine various information. To assess the consequences of decisions, managers need information. Various sources can provide information helpful in forecasting the future. One source is market research. Another source is input from experts. Still another is computer techniques and formal forecast. One useful approach to assessing the consequences of various courses of action is a list of pros and cons for each alternative. Decision makers must try to determine the possible consequences of each solution and the probability those consequences will occur. Thus, risk can be clarified and uncertainty reduced. So you must identify and diagnose the problem. You generate alternative solutions. You evaluate these alternatives. And then you make the choice. Ultimately, decisions and decision makers must choose from their alternatives. This is the fourth stage in the decision-making process. The choice, of course, is rarely clear-cut. And then once you make the choice, you must implement that decision. The decision-making process does not end in one simple choice. The choice alternative must be implemented. Sometimes the people involved in making the choice must put it into effect. At other times, they delegate the responsibility for implementation to others, such as when a management team changes a policy or an operating procedure and has first-line supervisors carry out the change. Those who implement the decision must understand the choice and why it was made. They also must be committed to its successful implementation. These needs can be set by involving those people in the early stages of the implementation process. Managers should plan implementation carefully. Adequate planning requires several steps. First, determine how things will look when the decision is fully operational. Second, chronologically order, perhaps with a flow chart or diagram, the steps necessary to achieve a full operational decision. Thirdly, list the resources and activities required to implement each step. Fourthly, establish the time needed for each step. And fifthly, assign responsibility for each step to specific individuals. Now we come to the final stage of decision making. Again, just to recap, number one, identify and diagnose the problem. Number two, generate alternative solutions. Number three, evaluate alternatives. Number four, make the choice. Number five, implement the decision. And then finally, evaluate the decision. The final stage in the decision-making process is evaluating the decision. This means collecting information on how well the decision is working. A 20% sales increase, for example, or an 80% reduction in accidents, or 100% on-time deliveries. These can be set even before the solution to the problem is put into effect. Then, objective data can be gathered to accurately determine the success or failure of the decision. Decision evaluation is useful whether the feedback is positive or negative. Feedback that suggests the decision is working implies that the decision should be continued and perhaps applied elsewhere in the organization. Negative feedback, which indicates failure, means that either implementation will require more time, resources, effort, or thought, or that the decision was a bad one. If the decision appears inappropriate, it's back to the drawing board. Then the process cycles back to the first stage where you have a definition or redefinition of the problem. The decision-making process begins anew, preferably with more information, new suggestions, and an approach that attempts to eliminate the mistakes which were made the first time around. This brings us to the end of number 6.